Call to order a meeting of the House Committee on Judiciary for January 17, 2007, and we'll be taking up a set of bills today that deal with underage drinking and the outcome or the recommendations made by a task force supported by the Department of Justice. And what we'll be doing is bringing up witnesses and panels. I'm going to open a public hearing on all the bills together so that we can hear about these ideas and because there's significant overlap among them. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bills 2144, 2145, 2146, 2147, 2148, 2149, 2150, 2151, and 2152. The first panel of the arranged testimony will bring forward then Attorney General Hardy Myers. Welcome, Attorney General. And Representative Tom Butler and Representative Barnhart, if he's here. I don't see
a
conflict, so I'll rely on these first two gentlemen to give us an introduction. Please begin by identifying yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Hardy Myers, Attorney General, for the record. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity very briefly to open the committee's considerations of this group of proposals that have emerged from the work of what is called the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. The formation, the work of the task force was took its source from a recommendation from the Leadership for Alcohol-Free Kids, which is a consortium of governmental and private entities who are involved with alcohol-related issues. And among the recommendations of the leadership to the governor was for the governor to invite me to create a task force to examine the issue of improving the enforcement and adjudication of liquor laws in Oregon. I was, of course, very pleased to accept that invitation. And the resulting task force of 37 members worked a substantial part of a year in reaching its recommendations, which I think were consensus recommendations of the 37 members. And those are the measures that are before you on your agenda today. I would only add at this point, Mr. Chair and members, that I sincerely hope that the work of the task force will appear to you as you work through and become familiar with the recommendations, that the work of the task force will in your view be an important step forward in the quality, if you will, of our laws relating to underage drinking in Oregon. With that, I'm very pleased to hand off, if I may, to your colleague, who is also a very important member of the task force.
Attorney General, thank you for your leadership on this issue. We look forward to learning more about what the recommendations are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60 in Southeast Oregon. I have some prepared remarks relative to this series of bills, but first of all, I would like to express my gratitude to the Attorney General and his staff for taking leadership roles. As well as Oregon's First Lady, Mary Oberst, for the work which she has done and her untiring dedication to the issues which deal with the youth of the state of Oregon. We have a responsibility to reduce underage drinking in the state of Oregon. In 2005, 33% of 8th grade girls and 27% of 8th grade boys reported using alcohol. Well over half of those children reported that obtaining alcohol was very easy. This is an important first step in changing the children's attitudes towards drinking. That's because kids between 12 and 14 years of age think that the positive influences and outcomes of drinking more than outweigh the negative influences of obtaining and drinking alcohol and consuming illegally. To address the issue, the legislature really needs to look at this list of laws to enforce and enhance the policies to become more consistent in underage drinking. I really would subscribe to you that the report on gives guidance as to what we can do to actually strengthen our laws towards restricting minors' access to alcohol. And prevention means more than just simply informing kids of the dangers of alcohol. It really is to work to give them the proper support and promote positive alcohol-free environments as well as within their homes. Now, one of the things that we probably too frequently gloss over is the fact that there's a significant cost in the consumption of alcohol by minors. And that cost of underage drinking now is approaching, well, in 2001, the most recent date for which I have the amount, was approaching at that time $700 million per annum in just medical costs and lost productivity. That translates into over $2,000 for every child in the state of Oregon. And if we can overcome that additional cost to us, then we can have the resources that are necessary for the other kinds of programs to encourage our youngsters to be able to be anxiously engaged in good causes. And finally, I'd like to just put a personal face on that which you're involved in here today. I think many of you know that I'm a family man. Mrs. Butler and I are blessed with five youngsters in our home. And one of our daughters, at the age of 13, was introduced to the use of hard alcohol in the home and from a very trusted middle school teacher. And we didn't know it. At age 13, we did not know that was that had affected her life. And now we celebrate, in addition to her birthday each year, we celebrate June 23rd as the day that she actually became free from alcohol many years later as she became addicted to alcohol and drugs. And I don't think that there's enough that I can say about the importance of parents being actively engaged in their children's lives and recognizing that that there should be penalties involved where parents are allowed to indiscriminately offer alcohol in their homes. And my daughter was given hard liquor with one of her classmates by a seventh grade teacher at the age of 13 and thus became an alcoholic in her young life. And for that I'm very sorry, but I'm also grateful for the system which provides us these kinds of opportunities to lift up the hands which hang down and strengthen the feeble knee. So I encourage and admonish this committee to look very circumspectly at this list of very excellent bills as has been produced by the Underage Drinking Task Force. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for these witnesses? Then thank you very much, Attorney General Myers and Representative Butler, for that opening presentation. The next panel, I would invite forward First Lady Mary Oberst and Phil Schradl from the Department of Justice. And just if you could pause for a moment before you start, because we need to connect Pam Erickson, who served in the task force, in by telephone.
Hello, this is Pam Erickson.
Pam, this is Greg McPherson, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Now we have you on a speakerphone here, and we're in a, to describe the scene, we're in a hearing room 357 in the Oregon Capitol with a good crowd of several dozen people here and a committee of nine members eager to hear more about the Underage Drinking Task Force. And we've got accompanying you on this panel, we have First Lady Mary Oberst and Phil Schradl from the Department of Justice. And I would open it to the three of you to decide then in what order you're going to present to the committee.
Okay. Thank you so much for making this accommodation to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, the weather has dealt us a few obstacles here in the last 24 hours, but I think we're managing all right.
All right.
My suggestion would have the First Lady go first.
Please. First Lady Mary Oberst, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Oberst. I wanted to talk to you for a moment about the scope of the problem of underage drinking in Oregon. Representative Butler mentioned some statistics for you, but I want to go a little further than what he mentioned. By the time that kids have reached the eighth grade, according to recent studies, over half of those 14-year-olds report having consumed a drink of alcohol, and almost a third have consumed a drink, one or more drinks, in the last 30 days. By the time kids have reached the 11th grade, almost half of those kids report drinking on one or more occasions in the last 30 days, and almost a third have engaged in binge drinking, which is five or more drinks all in a row. In a 2005 statewide survey of middle and high school youth, 59% of 8th graders and 81% of 11th graders believed that alcohol was fairly easy or very easy to obtain. These statistics are alarmingly high. In fact, Oregon statistics show that our kids drink more than the national average. The task force wondered, why is that? And some of the reasons include the willingness of friends and family to supply alcohol in private settings. And again, Representative Butler's own personal experience brings that to the fore. There's also a lack of consequences that adults face when they supply alcohol to kids. There's an ease for minors to successfully use false ID to obtain alcohol, and it's easy for minors to purchase alcohol without any identification at all. So the task force addressed all those issues, and the recommendations that we bring to you today directly address these reasons. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Mr. Schradl.
Chair McPherson, I asked Pam Erickson to provide her comments next, but to set the context for that, I'm Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, for the record. I provided to the members of the committee a two-page back-to-back on Oregon Partnership Know the Facts About Underage Alcohol Use, and that provides a number of statistics as recently as 2005, I think the statistics show, about alcohol consumption in Oregon. Then there should also be a one-page back-to-back on underage drinking in Oregon, the facts, and showing problems and costs associated with underage drinking in Oregon. And then the third background piece of information that I thought was of significant interest was, and we see these all the time, but it's a report out of the Daily Astorian dated January 10th, 2007, about the Seaside leaders focusing on ways to battle underage drinking. And at the they've recently just taken the action of doing a proclamation in Seaside supporting a zero tolerance policy for underage drinking. And the basis for that basically is the Seaside police chief says that underage drinking leads to violent sexual assault, property crime, and tragic traffic accidents. And that's really the background reasons of why the task force was created and why we're here. And with that, by way of kind of introduction, so that you'll have some background context for Pam Erickson's comments, I'd ask Pam to address things.
Okay. Ms. Erickson?
Did we lose her?
Hello.
Can you hear us?
Hang up and try her again. She was there.
Hello.
Yeah. Oh. Let's try it. I'll hang up and try her again.
Pam Erickson.
Hi, it's Greg McPherson with the House Judiciary Committee again. I think we lost you there at some point during Mr. Schradl's comments.
You did.
Okay.
All is well now.
Okay, very good. Well, we were just turning the floor over to you, if that's all right, to make your presentation to the committee.
Okay, first of all, my name is Pamela Erickson. I'm Deputy Director of Oregon Partnership, a nonprofit specializing in alcohol and drug abuse prevention. I've worked on underage drinking issues for over 10 years. For seven of those years, I was director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. For the past almost 4 years, I've been working at the Oregon Partnership on these issues. Let me give you a little bit of background, and if I cover something that's already been covered, let me know since I didn't hear the previous testimony, okay?
Fair enough.
In 2003, Congress Congress asked the Institute of Medicine and National Academy of Sciences to study underage drinking. In 2003, they issued a report called Underage Drinking, a Collective Responsibility. Judy Cushing, who is the president of Oregon Partnership, sat on a 12-member citizen expert panel to guide that study. They developed a series of recommendations for underage drinking that really called for everyone to do their part to reduce this very serious problem. Judy Cushing would have been with you today. She's recovering from some minor surgery and, of course, is to no bounds like I am. But Judy and I felt that our state ought to take a look at those recommendations from the National Academy of Sciences and see whether we ought to adopt any of them in our state. All of those recommendations were developed after an extensive review of the most recent research on this issue. Judy and I put together a statewide coalition of people representing education, schools, parents, law enforcement, the treatment community, and local people, and came up with a series of recommendations after meeting for about 6 months. We presented those to the governor. One of the things that we asked was for the Attorney General to appoint a task force to do something to make our laws more effective. We actually have pretty good laws, but they don't always work as they were intended. One of the things that we realized in working on this task force was that the language for those under 18 who fall within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, the language is different. For example, there are several laws that require the suspension of a driver's license if a youth is convicted. Well, youth under 18 that fall within the jurisdiction of the juvenile department almost never get convicted. That's not the language they use. And they rarely use a formal proceeding that will get you something that's tantamount to a conviction. So the driver's license suspension almost never happens. We also found that in some counties, particularly Multnomah County, due to budget cuts, have decided basically not to do anything with youth who are arrested for minor in possession. The only thing that happens is that a letter goes home to the parent saying, your child was arrested for this crime, we're referring this to you. Our liquor laws, as research indicates, are actually pretty effective, but of course they have to be enforced to be effective. So the task force spent a lot of time looking at some of our laws to make some adjustments so that they actually can work a little better than they do now. One of the other issues that we found was that some parents actually support underage drinking by holding drinking parties in their homes or allowing their children to attend such parties. And oftentimes, the idea is that the parent thinks that's the safer approach. They seem to have just accepted the idea that their child will drink, but want to do it in a safe location. In fact, those situations are not safe at all. We have a study now that says that children whose parents furnish parties or whose friends' parents furnished parties are twice as likely to drink than other kids. The best thing a parent can do is to institute a rule that says we're going to be following the Oregon law here and you will not be drinking until you're 21. That kind of home rule is very, very effective. Unfortunately, most parents don't do it either because they've accepted the fact that their child will drink, and actually, a lot of kids don't drink. Or parents just assume their child knows that they don't approve. So we've been working very hard to try to get a series of things going. First, to alert parents that this is a very serious problem. Second, to enhance law enforcement. Third, to enhance treatment options. There are a whole series of things that really need to be done to curb this serious problem. Just a couple of comments on some very disturbing trends that I don't know that everybody knows about. And one is the increase in girls drinking. We now have the situation of girls drinking at higher rates than boys in all age categories. That's particularly scary because girls in the eighth grade are now drinking at much higher rates than boys. About 35% of girls report drinking in the last month. The other thing that we have found is that parties nowadays are really quite dangerous things. We talk to kids a lot because we work with a lot of youth groups, and we ask them about parties. And they tell us that there are often other drugs at parties. So a child often is introduced to things like marijuana, sometimes methamphetamine, cocaine, other kinds of dangerous drugs at parties. Parties are usually very unsupervised. They tend to be very spontaneous nowadays. Children have instant messaging, email. They can organize parties literally within a half hour. They know homes where parents aren't there, and oftentimes kids show up unannounced and they have an instant party. The other thing that we found, which is very scary, is that young girls, eighth grade girls, are getting their alcohol from older males. We've never seen youth parties where adults and children mix in a party scene. And kids tell us that happens fairly frequently now. So these are all things that are kind of scary, and we really need to wake up and do something about it. Kids really look to adults and look to their advice. There's a study called the Roper Report that's done every year, and they ask kids, what is the strongest influence on your decision whether to drink or do drugs? And about 70% of kids say their parents. Well, adults are really, really crucial to this issue. And there are a lot of things that we can do. And the series of bills that have been recommended by this committee should help a lot. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Erickson? Thank you very much speaking to our group here, even at a distance.
You're very welcome, and if anyone has a question at a later date, I'd be very happy to be responsive to you and the members of your committee. Thank you so much for making this accommodation.
Yes, very good. Thank you for being with us. Mr. Schradl, should we break the line off here then and turn it over to you?
I think so. Thank you.
Bye.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, again, Phil Schradl with the Attorney General's Office. I was privileged to chair the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force, and on the record, I wanted to commend the members of that task force for their time, energy, and effort and the capability that they brought to it. It was a wide-ranging group. Attorney General Myers mentioned that there were about 37 participants covering law enforcement, higher education community, members of the legislature, law enforcement, treatment service providers, wide range of entities and experiences. We focused our energy not on dealing with the larger societal norms. Underage drinking is a complex issue, and there are many, many variables and factors that go into it. But what we were focused on was a review of the Oregon statutory provisions that are addressed to underage drinking and looking at whether there were either fine-tuning changes that we would suggest to you or a different approach. The set of proposals that you have in front of you, we provided, I think, all the members of the committee with copies of the Underage Drinking Task Force. And I'll go through a little brief summary of the bills and proposals that are in there. And just to help cross-reference, the LC numbers were all that we had at the time that we put the task force together, so I'll make reference to the House bills as we go through. But I want to remind the committee members, too, that these proposals simply need to be part of a larger discussion out there in society. And we look forward to working with the committee as you go forward in your consideration of these bills, and would be happy to provide any additional help, resources, and certainly engage in further conversations about them. The first six bills that are in the package of proposals are in the appendices to the Underage Drinking Task Force are the LC numbers 976 through 981. LC 976 in the appendices is now denominated as House Bill 2144. And that bill, and by the way, I have provided written testimony for the record on each of these bills, providing you with a summary of the bill and the change that it undertakes. House Bill 2144 would add alcohol into the Endangering the Welfare of a Minor statute. That's ORS 163.575. And that would simply be an expression. Right now it applies to controlled substances, but it doesn't have a provision that addresses alcohol. And the task force was firmly of the belief that it should be included in that statute because it provides, as Ms. Erickson was describing to you, the same dangers that are associated with maintaining an environment for minors where they are exposed to controlled substances. Alcohol is dangerous as well. LC 977 appended to the report is now House Bill 2145. And 2145 amends ORS 471-410. And it changes the standard for when parents are able to provide alcohol to their own minor children. There is currently a statutory exception for that. And that is a recognition, I think, of different ways that people choose to raise their children, whether that's for cultural, religious, whatever differences that they might have. We would recommend strongly that change right now, you can provide alcohol to your own minor child until the child is visibly intoxicated. And we think that standard is too high and that it actually should be more in the neighborhood of compared to a noticeable degree. We think that's a better balance to bring that freedom of how you want to raise your own kids by exposing, teaching them how you might choose to use alcohol, shouldn't go as far as getting minor children drunk. LC 978 is now denominated as House Bill 2146, and that changes the suspension of driving privileges in the juvenile statutes and calls for a mandatory driver's license suspension when the minor has been summoned to appear in court to defend against a minor in possession charge but fails to appear. One of the very consistent themes for us, for the task force, evidence that's out there and the studies that have been done show that swift and sure consequences are really the best way of getting youth's attention. And this is one of those pieces that we would suggest that you give consideration to. That means that if somebody simply fails to show at their hearing, that they should have their driver's license suspended for the failure to show. Because otherwise, right now, things are happening where not much is happening as the process works its way through. LC 979 is now House Bill 2147. And that expands the age range for denial of driving privileges for possession, use, or abuse of alcohol. And right now, that statute only applies to those youths ages 13 to 17, and we recommend and would suggest that statute should be changed to also apply to persons 18 to 20. And there seems to be no logical differentiation as to why it doesn't, and we think it simply was something that happened over the course of years that just didn't catch up. LC 980 is House Bill 2148, and that creates a new subcategory of minor in possession while driving. And the task force brings that recommendation to you, noting that the significant dangers associated with drinking and driving, and they're currently, whether you're a minor in possession, just have a beer in your own backyard, or whether you have it in your vehicle, there's no differentiation in the severity that's considered to be. And our suggestion would be to make that a new subcategory of minor in possession while driving and have that be a Class A violation. LC 981 is House Bill 2149, and that amends ORS 471-430 to authorize a court to order assessment and treatment for all persons under the age of 21. Currently, that statute only authorizes that for persons aged 18 to 20, and this again is one that seemed to the task force to be rather anomalous. The court doesn't have the authority currently under the statute to order assessment and treatment for younger youths, but does have the statutory authority for 18 to 20.
Mr. Schrader, we have a question from Representative Wisnett. Would you prefer to complete your overview of the bills before we start asking specific questions?
Chairman McPherson, however the committee wants to handle is just fine with me.
Representative Wisnett, would you
thank you, Mr.
Like
Chair.
To ask it now?
Thank you,
go
Mr.
Ahead?
Chair. And I'm going through, I'm sorry which bill it is, but in reading your report and your recommendations and the bills for this meeting, you have a 90-day, the penalty for the first offense is 90 days suspension, and the second one is for 1 year. And then you said 1 year for thereafter. Did you consider, discuss suspending license after the second time to 21 years of age?
I mean, Jerry McPherson, Representative Wisnett, your questions go to House Bill 2152, which we'll be talking about momentarily.
Sorry.
But the question about length of suspension was discussed within the task force, and we thought there should be a graduated system of suspensions. And you're correct that the first administrative suspension would be for 90 days, and a repeat offender, the suspension would be for a year. We didn't give consideration to moving that until on a third offense, for example, to the age of 21. That's something that I think the committee should give consideration to. Typically, I think you'd be dealing with a time frame where the driver's license wouldn't be available to the person until they were at least age 15. Hopefully, they would get the idea by the time they've had a third offense, which they'd already would have had, 2 years and a quarter of suspension. But it's certainly something to consider. Like I said before, we're certainly more than interested in engaging with the committee in further discussions about suggested changes, modifications. I'll focus on 2152 in just a moment, if that's okay.
Thank you.
The next two bills in the packet that we're bringing to you are ones that came from the impetus behind them was from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and that is LC 982, which is House Bill 2150, and LC 983, which is House Bill 2151. I'll briefly summarize them now, but Rudy Williams from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is here today and will be in a subsequent panel and can provide more depth about those. House Bill 2150 amends ORS 471-346, and that would authorize random minor decoy operations in cities with populations over 500,000. Currently, that would be the Portland metropolitan area. And it would authorize the authorities to use a specified geographical area within that. They would have to be certain specified geographical areas. They couldn't pick and choose which ones. And they would have to conduct random decoy operations within those specified areas. This was suggested, and the rationale and understanding is that within the Portland metropolitan area, to conduct random minor decoy operations across the whole breadth of the metropolitan area is very ineffective and costly, because when the computer generates randomized sites, it may be on the Beaverton side and then on the Gresham side and the north side and the south side. And so all this would do would be to break it down so that you have a smaller geographical area. You still have to do it randomized within that smaller geographical area. This is a cost savings that would allow them to use their resources more effectively.
Representative Kump.
Thanks, Chair McPherson. Question about, now I understand that this is just to create a random kind of a sort for big cities, but is this statute relevant to smaller cities? Woodburn has, 20,000-25,000 people. Are organizations, DEA, allowed to do a random, search
McPherson,
like this?
Representative Comp, it's my understanding, perhaps Mr. Williams can address it in more depth, but that for communities, I believe it's over 20,000 in population, that there is an authorization to do randomized minor decoy operations. So this wouldn't affect that at all. it wouldn't have any effect for the city of Woodburn or any other city, actually now, except for in the Portland metropolitan area. That's the only one.
Yes.
My concern is quite maybe the opposite of what you think. I believe we need this.
Mm-hmm.
And that every community, when you get your head on out from under the carpet, needs some sort of intervention to matter to desperately. We need desperately to unearth this problem. It's probably much bigger than what was even stated this morning.
Yeah. Chairman McPherson, Representative Comp, I think I understood your question, and I think that it would already be authorized within the city of Woodburn, since it's over 20,000, to do randomized minor decoy operations. This wouldn't negate that. It would just not affect it.
Right. Thank you.
The other bill, LC 983, House Bill 2151, would amend ORS 471-315, and that would change the standard for OLCC licensees. Currently, it's only a violation if they sell alcohol to a minor where the licensee mentally knew that they were selling to a minor. We suggest that change should be to knew or should have known. It is easy for a licensee to kind of hide their head in the sand and not undertake what would be reasonable steps to know whether the person was under the age of 21. For example, not either carefully checking IDs or not even asking for IDs. And a knowing or should have known standard would allow the OLCC to reach those licensees who are not actively engaged in enforcing the underage drinking statutes themselves. The last proposal, LC 985, is House Bill 2152. That's the lengthiest bill that we're coming forward to you with the recommendation to support. That creates an administrative driving privilege suspension program, and that would apply to persons between the ages of 15 to 20 who violate the MIP provisions. This is complementary to other existing statutory provisions that exist. And the desire here is to have a cost-effective, quick administrative manner in which to bring the consequences to bear on children who engage in violate minor and possession provisions. There's a citation process and then a hearing process, all modeled on the implied consent statutes. If a police officer cites a youth for minor in possession, they would be subject to an administrative driver's license suspension. They could challenge that citation and the grounds for that suspension through a hearing process. And it involves this graduated suspension penalties that Representative Wisnett was asking about before. For a first-time offender, it would be a 90-day suspension. For a second-time offender, it would be a one-year suspension, and subsequent suspensions would also be a one-year under the current proposal. There are certainly provisions for both hardship permits and emergency permits to cover circumstances where youth and their family may need that transportation. That's the only available source of transportation for work or treatment or for school. The costs associated with this are proposed to be designed to be recovered by the Department of Motor Vehicles through an enhancement on their current level for reinstatement fees across the board for all driver's licenses. When somebody gets revoked or suspended and then needs to be reinstated, there is a fee associated with that. And the idea that we come forward to you with is to fund the costs that might be associated with this administrative suspension program through an enhanced fee. There's fiscal work that has been done by the DMV that underlays this. I'm not sure whether Ms. Young, who is also here today, who will give you more in-depth comments about that or can answer questions better than I, I'm not sure whether that financial fiscal impact has been generated for the committee today, but we certainly will do that. In closing, really, what I want to suggest to the committee is that the work of the task force is really just, a part of a bigger discussion that I think needs to occur. Oregon statutes are actually pretty good. The enforcement about them across the state is very varied. Going from county to county, the rates that citations would be issued or people would actually receive penalties through the court system vary substantially, in part, I think, driven by cost. That's why one of the programs that we bring forward to you is what we hope is actually a cheaper, more effective way of getting at enforcement actions through the Administrative Driver's License Suspension Program. Be happy to answer any questions, but we also have other panel members who have more expertise than I.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schradl, I agree very much with most of what I see here because of my background, you know, state police, and same with our companion here. But I'm wondering a little bit, you know, the old standard of knowingly sell. I'm looking at the paper that you put out, and then I go down to should or should have known, or knew or should have known. And then there's places in there that talks about signs were objectively present. If you go to the law, you find definitions beyond a reasonable doubt, preponderance of evidence, probable cause, and they got this objective standard. And you try to apply this to the understanding that the average clerk that's getting paid $7.80 an hour now, how do you get those people to understand what they're supposed to be doing besides checking the ID, and how are they going to measure whether this person is intoxicated to some degree, to some standard? I mean, I don't know if right now, if you were to take a piece of paper and have us, what we've heard today, write it out, we couldn't say with this group, with two attorneys, I'm willing to bet you, how do you get that to where a clerk understands it?
Mm-hmm. Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the primary driver for the task force was the knew or should have known that the person was under the age of 21. OLCC may have different interests that they want to, you know, push for the committee's consideration too, but the primary driver for the task force was knew or should have known that the person was under the age of 21. That is a bit more objective, I think, and there are numbers of objective criteria that one could look at, such as did they affirmatively ask for ID and did they check it? So with respect to that piece of the proposal, I think there are ways then, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, I think, does a statewide job of trying to train all Oregon licensees about what the standard procedures would be and what steps they should take to ensure that they aren't serving to minors. And, you know, so understood the concern in question, I think, especially with respect to the underage drinking component of that, however, I think there would be objective criteria that could be used.
Follow up.
Yeah, I agree with that portion of it. What about the portion of to a person who is visibly intoxicated? If we were all here to look at an individual by his voice, his slur, his walk, just his mannerism, maybe his clothes, his, you know, his person, one of us might think, yeah, he's visibly intoxicated. Well, he's on the borderline. How do they do that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I agree. That's a very subjective evaluation, and, in fact, I think that that's a difficulty for police officers who are you know, well-trained in that, too, for sobriety stops. But there are, you know, ways in which things could be tightened up. I agree there might be some subjective calls that need to be made, but I think there are even some subjective calls about whether the person knew. All that we would be changing would be whether they knew or reasonably should have known. I don't think we'd be changing the criteria of what kinds of things that you needed to evaluate to determine whether the person was visibly intoxicated or not. So I agree that's something that we should have further conversation about, frankly.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you so much. First of all, I want to thank the task force for all your work. As a parent of teenagers, I certainly appreciate both the problem and the need to address it. I do have a question about 2145 that changes from visibly intoxicated to impaired to a noticeable degree. And I noticed that, for Mr. Schradl, in your notes that you submitted here, you said that it is designed to accommodate religious and cultural practices, but I don't see that in the bill as it is in 2149, and with a standard like impaired to a noticeable degree. I'm wondering if, for example, a parent could give a final glass of wine at a Passover Seder to a 17-year-old who's smiling a little bit more than usual. And I just wonder about the lack of the religious exemption in this bill with the presence in another bill. Is there a reason why it's not in there with the loosening of that standard?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I'm unaware that whether there is a statute that carves out an exception for religious practice. It was our understanding that that was what this statute had originally, why it had this, you know, exception to it at all. And I don't think, well, two responses to your question. One is, I think that there certainly would be an enforcement component to this that I don't think that we would be yet existing, and I hope that we would never be, in a state where we would have, you know, law enforcement wandering around looking for minors or adults who might be, you know, serving at a Seder a glass of wine to their youth and have them charged under the statute. But that said, it's simply, I mean, we think it appropriate not to have the standard be that you could be serving alcohol to a minor to the point that they were drunk, to visibly intoxicated. And that is the current standard. And so, you know, if that last glass of wine at the Seder did make the person, you know, intoxicated, drunk, I mean, I doubt that that would ever be, frankly, enforced. But if it were, I don't know. That's, a call for the committee to make. Our belief was that this would be a more reasonable way of balancing the exercise of those religious rights and way of raising your kids without, teaching abuse of alcohol.
Thank you. And then follow-up? I have a follow-up on I believe it's 52. The administrative driving suspension program, has a similar program been implemented in any other state or jurisdiction? And if so, how is it working, with regard to due process rights? Thank you.
Chairman McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that's an excellent question. I'm unaware of the answer to that. I will look into that. Maybe Ms. Youngs, who's here from DMV, knows whether there are in other states. We have certainly created and within this, we think, you know, appropriate due process safety guard regards because we have the hearing process. You can challenge the citation. There's judicial review. It's simply a contested case matter if you want to take it to contested case.
Thank you.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think every member of this committee would support your effort and wants to, we all have the same objective in mind and goal. On 2151, it's already been discussed that I think that we, you know, we really need help and why we need to change that statute, because all you're changing now is going from knowingly, and you're adding now knew or should have known. And I think that's something we need to further discuss and maybe have any background from your discussions with the work group. I don't understand the need for that. We already have the OLCCs, you know, programs and efforts to do that, and that's just, I'm not sure that we're accomplishing. My people back home say, you know, your job, Wisdom, is not to pass bills, it's to get rid of bills. So here we're, you know, I'm not sure we're accomplishing much with this change, except a big burden on the vendors, and which they already have a program to try to be sure we're doing the right, they're doing the right thing, and we're helping this prevent underage drinking.
Chairman McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I think Rudy Williams from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is here today and will provide, I think, you the background that may be helpful in answering that. And I think he can discuss with you the difficulties that there are in enforcing under the current statute.
Thank you.
In fact, in that connection, Mr. Schradl, it seems to me the key question are the issues of proof, and I'm just wondering whether Mr. Williams is best equipped to comment on those, or whether you would. That is, at core, that distinction, it seems to me, is one of how effectively you can make a proof about the state of mind of the clerk who's selling the alcohol when you don't have a should-have-known element in the standard. Should we hear from Mr. Williams on that, or do you have a comment?
Chair McPherson, I'd be happy to provide some comments, too, and I think Mr. Williams will, too. I think one of the difficulties here, too, is the licensee themselves and getting at the licensee as well as the clerk. If the licensee doesn't have programs in place that would ensure that their clerks are not serving to underage drinkers, it would be very, very difficult to establish responsibility for the licensee, him or herself, because they wouldn't have been part of that transaction. what I think this moving to a new or should have known standard would be, if you're so lax in the way that you train your clerks and your employees that they engage in selling to underage drinkers, and you should have known that, that you could be found responsible for that as well. So that's one of the components, as well as the mental responsibility of the individual who actually was part of the transaction.
Thank you. Representative Wisner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait for the Mr. Williams, but since you mentioned this, did your task force look at the current law on the books now, the shared responsibility program, the vendor?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Wisner. We reviewed all of the statutes. We didn't look at those in detail, and we did hear from Mr. Williams and Phil Lang, who's the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, about the difficulties that they've had in enforcing under this statute, and that was why the recommendation is being brought forward to you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cameron.
Again, I want to thank you for all the work that's been done on the task force and all these bills. I have a question specifically on 2152. And this is in regards to the driver's license for suspension, and it talks about attempting to purchasing, acquiring, or possessing of alcoholic beverages. What about a minor who's attempting to enter into an establishment with a fake ID? I know that at that point in time they're not actually trying to acquire alcoholic beverages, but should there not be language in there? Even attempting to enter a premise that's restricted to minors where alcohol is being served, so that an establishment that's doing a good job and taking those IDs, they're frustrated many times, but, you know, the guy goes out and gets another ID.
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think that's a suggestion that should be given serious consideration. We didn't address that in the discussions that we had in the task force. Now, the language that is in the bill, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head right now whether it is attempting to purchase. It does include attempting to purchase, but I don't know whether that would go as far as your concern about simply, you know, attempting to enter into the premises where they would be barred. So that's something that I think should be given consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just have to ask this question, and it's that age variation between 18 and 20. What happens to college frat parties?
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, Representative Comp. Frat parties and the college scene, I think, are incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
concerns. And, you know, one of the differentiations that is in one of these bills is a recognition that parents may not be able to supervise as closely children who don't live in the home and are away at college. And that is recognized by way of not holding them accountable for that.
Okay.
Nevertheless, the minor in possession, all of the other statutes would apply directly to them. And again, this goes to enforcement and whether it is ever perceived and understood that it's actually happening. But
great.
Yes.
Great.
If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel. Thank you, Mr. Schradl. Yes. First Lady Oberst.
The last thing I do want to leave with the committee is Rob Bovet, Lincoln County Council, couldn't get here either because of the inclement weather. He did provide written testimony. I wanted to make sure that all the committee members received that as well. I think you did. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next panel consists of Jerry Cooper from Sonoma County, Rudy Williams from the OLCC, and Karen Wheeler from DHS. And Mr. Schradl, are all those physically present, or is somebody needing to attend by telephone?
Chair McPherson, Jerry Cooper needs to be called, and I left the telephone number here.
Okay, we have it.
Thank you very much.
So just pause for a moment while we get Mr. Cooper on the line.
Hello,
Judge Cooper.
Yes.
This is Greg McPherson, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. You're joining a panel along with a couple of others here in our hearing on the underage drinking set of bills.
Fine.
And we're taking testimony on all the bills as a group rather than breaking them out one by one, although we have talked about the specifics of several. And just so you have a sense of the scene here, we're in hearing room 357. We've got our nine-member committee here and a couple of dozen others who are members of the public and staff. And we have seated at the witness table Rudy Williams from the OLCC and Karen Wheeler from DHS. And so I don't know in what order. Did you have an arranged order among the three of you? Then Judge Cooper will go directly to you if that's all right.
That's fine. I'm sorry I can't be present. I live up by St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, and the roads just don't permit my getting down at this point.
Very good. Well, yeah, go ahead with your comments then.
All right. I'm the one of the two members of the task force appointed by the Chief Justice to represent the judicial branch. I'm a pro tem hearings referee in Multnomah County, and I've been doing that for 8 years, and I also was trial court administrator in Multnomah County for approximately 2.5 years. I was the Chief Deputy District Attorney in Washington County for many years, and I taught at the Oregon Police Academy for many years in Monmouth. So I've had a chance to think about these laws and to work with them. When I was appointed to the task force, I became the chair of the committee that reviewed all of the laws that now apply, and I don't know whether Mr. Schradl or any of the other members pointed out that we were, as a task force, very impressed with the fact that Oregon has very good laws in place. But there was a need for some fine-tuning, and that's what we've gone about doing here. And I'm going to be speaking about the first six proposals that you should have before you. So the first, and I'm looking at now the draft, but it's at the actual bill number. What I'm looking at is the lowest one, LC-976, but it has to do with the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor. This, up to now, has always dealt with controlled substances and other activities where persons under the age of 18 were permitted to remain and to observe and participate in certain types of activities. And one of the subsections dealt with unlawful activities involving controlled substances, and it was the task force belief that that should also include alcoholic liquor or types of activity where the unlawful, but instead of it applying across the board to minors at 21 or less than age, that we stay with the 18 years of age or younger because of the fact that so many of the kids become are treated like adults in many respects. They go off to college, and it's pretty hard for parents or someone who is the custodian or prior custodian to have any control. But the concern, of course, is when they're at college, there can be the fraternity and the sorority type of and any type of social event where there's underage drinking going on, even at under the age of 21. But the task force believes that 18 would be the appropriate cutoff on this one, and it does involve permitting a person to enter or remain in a place where unlawful activity involving drugs or alcoholic liquor would be maintained or conducted. And so understand, 18 was the under the age of 18 was the age that was decided upon and recommended by the task force. The next concept or bill would involve, and I have it as LC-977, but it would amend the provisions relating to making alcoholic liquor available to a minor. And the big concern that we had as a task force was that no person other than a parent or guardian can furnish alcoholic liquor to a person under 21. But the statute today would require that for a parent or guardian to be abusing the furnishing law, it would be when their child or ward became visibly intoxicated, which means drunk, and really showing the extreme effects of alcoholic usage. And it was the consensus of the task force that a parent shouldn't be able to furnish liquor to their own child or ward if they were visibly impaired, such as someone who would constitute being under the influence of intoxicants for driving a vehicle on public premises and public highways. And so the intent was to prohibit a parent or guardian from furnishing alcoholic liquor to someone who was a child or ward who was visibly impaired. Our concept was due to alcohol, the other intoxicants, controlled substances, or inhalants, just so it would be pretty much consistent with the driving while under the influence of intoxicant laws. And I noticed the language that's in the draft proposal is impaired to a noticeable degree. And, of course, impairment can be from other reasons, such as I was looking in the criminal code, mentally defective in the sex crimes talks about people who suffer from a mental disease or defect, rather than just being impaired due to intoxicants. So that's something that may need to be reviewed as to whether you want to limit it to what the impairment is caused by or keep it this general. But impaired hopefully would mean to a physical and or mental degree, any noticeable degree, when you're starting to show the influence, because again, that would be consistent with our DUI laws. And even if a parent is going to be allowed to teach their children how to drink, it should be in a responsible manner. And once you're under the influence to a noticeable degree, it's time to stop, and the kid should be taught that from the parent or their guardian. The other concept was it's not just getting access to the alcoholic liquor, but also who exercises control over the premises where the kids can have their parties and consume the alcoholic liquor. And up to now, it's been a violation, punishable by a fine. And the recommendation of the task force was to make it a Class A misdemeanor, which would make it a 1 year in county jail and a $6,250 fineable offense. But we were aware of the fact that the district attorneys, by statute, have the authority to reduce that to a violation if they believe it's appropriate. But at least it should start out as a crime, and the police would have the authority to search and seize and make arrests as a criminal matter, at least during the investigation and the taking people into custody and trying to deal with the situation if it's a big MIP party. And I think the next draft is 978, but this has to do with suspension of driving privileges of a juvenile in juvenile court. If they're cited for MIP, there's a summons issued, and they fail to appear on the summons, and there's also been a decision not to charge the child with failing to appear on a citation, but literally to suspend their driving privileges until they do take the right steps to deal with the matter in juvenile court. This is consistent with the adult court that I sit in. I deal with the 18 to 21 year olds. ORS 809.220 requires the court to suspend driving privileges of minors 18 to 21 if they fail to appear on a summons in the adult system. So it was the recommendation of the task force that the same mandatory suspension apply in juvenile court. And then draft LC 979, when a child has been convicted or adjudicated in juvenile court on any type of a controlled substance violation or alcohol violation, when they're 13 to 17, there are provisions where the court shall deny driving privileges. I think that's the terminology we use, and that means that the child would not be able to apply for a driver's license if they didn't have one already, or if they were they had an instruction permit at 15, they'd be suspended or denied the driving privilege, or if they had a driver's license at 16 or 17, the court would deny their driving privileges for periods of time. But after 90 days on the first offense, the court could review the situation and reinstate. And then after 1 year, if they have serious problems, the court can review and reinstate the driving privileges. What we're trying to do with the task force is make this apply across the board for all minors, not just the 13 to 17-year-old, but the 13-year-old to 20.
Judge, can I break in just with a question here? This is Representative Greg McPherson. A couple of the bills on suspension of driving privileges appear to me to be based on offenses or violations related to alcohol that are not driving related, and you were drawing a parallel between what happens to adults who fail to appear, for example, for DUI infraction, for example, and it would appear to me as though these bills go further in that they suspend driving privileges for alcohol-related offenses that are not driving-related. Am I understanding those correctly?
That's correct. This bill that I'm addressing right now, it was the concept was passed back in the 1983 session. Principal of Ashland Junior High School, Wes Smith, proposed it, and when it passed, he was on the Today Show. It was something that was new to the entire nation, and the concept was we want to get the kids' attention, and the one thing that when they're in that junior high and high school age group is they're driving privileges. So this was based on if you were convicted in adult court or it was you were found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court in juvenile court for any drug, controlled substance, or alcohol-related offense, you would lose your driving privileges. It's a mandatory provision. But that was for the 13 to 18-year-old because it got their attention. We're proposing that it be extended to the 21-year-old. And again, it's getting people's attention and using every piece of, ammunition you can to do that. But you're right, this is not aimed at necessarily a driving-related conviction. It's just the violation of the drug or the controlled substance or the alcoholic liquor law. Then on LC Draft 980, this is one that I feel strongly about. Up to now, we've said zero tolerance for minors to drive a vehicle when it comes to alcohol, but the way we get to that is you have to be arrested on probable cause that you're committed driving while under the influence of intoxicants. The operative breath test, take the breath test and register any amount of alcohol in your system, 0.01 or higher, and you're suspended for implied consent violation. But it is not necessarily driving under the influence of intoxicants at all. You still would have to be shown to be impaired beyond a reasonable doubt, physically or mentally, or 0.08 or higher driving the motor vehicle. So what this is all about is telling kids you can't drink any type of alcoholic liquor and get behind the wheel of a car and even be in a car with the alcohol present, because MIP means the actual personal possession of the alcohol or its container, or by consumption. You've consumed it, it's in your system, and this change in the law would be no person who's under 21 and operating a motor vehicle on public highways or premises of the public while committing the offense of minor in possession of alcoholic liquor. And it would be a violation punishable by a fine not to exceed $720. The issue that comes to my mind is that, and I haven't talked to DMV about this, is should this remain as part of the Chapter 471, the liquor laws, or should it be part of Chapter 811, the vehicle code, so that if the person is convicted, it would go on their driving record? And I will tell you at this time, my experience as a judge, and I've been doing it for 8 years, and spent a lot of time with parents on driving matters, let alone MIP. The one thing parents do not want to happen is to get anything on a driving record where the insurance companies might have access. And the biggest problem I see with the kids is getting the parents invested in paying attention and properly teaching them how to drink responsibly and monitoring what the kids are doing. So if it remained under the liquor laws, then the courts could basically take action or not. And if there was a conviction or adjudication, it wouldn't go on a driving record. It would, if it was part of Chapter 811, I believe it would, and the rules of the road. And I don't know if DMV would have any type of fiscal impact problem with that, but I would at least bring that up at this time. And then finally, LC 981, we're looking at here is for all ages but under 21, if convicted of minor in possession of liquor, the court may order the person undergo assessment and treatment for any type of alcohol problem. And if they have a prior violation, then the court shall order the person undergo assessment and treatment. That's not the case today. This would make it uniform for both minors under 18 as well as under 18 to 21. So it's just kind of bringing everybody together and having the same law and application apply. And I think that's pretty much the first six. I think that's what Mr. Schradl wanted me to cover. Be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Judge Cooper? Not seeing any. So, Judge, thank you very much for presenting to us. We appreciate the information.
All right, thank you.
Bye now. Okay, Rudy Williams. Or would you, we could go to Karen Wheeler first, if you prefer.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager for the Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health Division. Our division administers Oregon's portion of the federal underage drinking laws program. That's a block grant from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. It's $350,000 a year. And that grant is used to support law enforcement efforts as well as other community efforts to address the issue of underage drinking. As I'm sitting here listening to this, I'm reflecting on my adolescence, and I grew up in Oregon. I grew up in Coos County, Coquille, Oregon. And I'll date myself and say that I was a high school student in the 1970s. I do remember a lot of underage drinking going on in the 70s in Coquille, Oregon, right here. I would say also that the application of laws was not consistent in Coos County at that time. Many of my friends, beer was just poured out by the police, and they sent us on our way home. I would say also that the cultural norms were very conducive to underage drinking at that time, and they remain so today. So the division not only supports law enforcement efforts to address underage drinking, but we also look at the broader context of families and communities and what we can do to apply prevention strategies to multiple domains that children actually live in. They have a peer domain, they have families, they live in communities, they have schools. All of these domains have an impact on whether or not they choose to drink or use other drugs. The department supports all 9 of these bills. We also would like to thank the task force. We thank the committee and as well the First Lady for taking this issue on. These bills provide consistent penalties for those cited for underage drinking laws, regardless of age. Also provide law enforcement with additional tools in dealing with underage drinkers. And I'm not going to repeat any of the statistics that you may have heard or have in your information. I did provide a fact sheet that our office developed. We're in the process of updating that fact sheet with the 2006 Oregon Healthy Teen Survey data right now. The 2006 data shows that past 30-day alcohol use rates and binge drinking among 8th graders, especially for females, is continuing to rise in Oregon. Nationally, trends in this area are going down. There's a survey called the Monitoring the Future Survey that showed 30-day alcohol use by 8th graders across the country at 17.2%, while Oregon's is 31.9%, so we're at double the national rate. For girls, the 2006 survey showed alcohol use rates for 8th graders at 33.9%, and for boys, 29.9%. So again, girls are outpacing the boys. I will just mention that we have implemented a gender-specific prevention program. It's called Friendly Persuasion. It's an evidence-based practice for gender-specific prevention for girls. Data consistently show a correlation between minors' perception of harm in drinking. So if they think it's harmful, they're less likely to start drinking. Also, the data shows that if minors think there are going to be consequences, and those consequences are going to be consistently applied to them, they're less likely to drink. So again, I think the work of this task force is important. House Bill 2149 is of particular interest to us, as it provides for an assessment and treatment for minors regardless of their age. Currently, the law provides this option for those over 18. I will say that a few weeks ago, visiting a residential addiction treatment program for adolescents, I met a 12-year-old in that program. I would say that younger and younger kids are entering treatment programs with problems, significant problems with alcohol and other substances. And what they tell me when I go visit these programs is that their parents think, well, at least they're just drinking, they're not using methamphetamine. Or at least they're only drinking alcohol, they're not smoking pot. And cigarettes is another issue. I know we're not here talking about that. But all of these drugs, and believe me, they are gateway drugs, have a tremendous impact on children and youth and communities in Oregon. So, again, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm available if you have any questions of me or of my staff related to these bills or anything else related to underage drinking prevention. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ms. Wheeler? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And convincing kids that alcohol is bad, I don't know how you do that when, in just watching television, it seems like if I was a young person, I would assume the only way I could be popular, happy, and hang around with great, sexy people would be to drink.
Right.
I mean, so how do you convince them that something's not good about drinking unless they have a drunk dad that's beating them?
Representative McPherson and Representative Barker, I would definitely say we're not here talking about the media and advertising, but that is a huge impact on youth and what they think about alcohol as well as other things to do. And I don't even think 2 days would touch that topic.
No.
It's a huge topic.
I mean, I don't know how you overcome that with your program. That was kind of what I was asking.
Chairman Gerson, Representative Barker, I would again stress that children and youth, the biggest impact is parents. What parents tell kids is okay and not okay, and also enforcing the limits and the consequences. And one thing that we've done, and it's just sort of a drop in the bucket, but what we have done with some of this money that I referred to earlier is we've contracted with the Oregon Partnership to do a statewide public education campaign for parents specifically on underage drinking. It's called Think Again, Parents. And so you may hear some things on the radio. You may see some print advertising as well. But we really want parents to get the message that it is not okay to drink if you're underage, and please do not promote that or support that in your home.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You referenced the 12-year-old that you had encountered at a treatment facility. Is there any research or work that's been done that tracks under 13 alcohol use and abuse?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores. I would say that there's definitely a body of research related to the onset of alcohol use and future consequences. The earlier a child starts to drink, the more likely they are to develop alcohol dependence and drug dependence. And the same correlation is true for smoking, for beginning to use nicotine and cigarettes. And the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse is one place to go to for that research. And I'd be happy to provide the committee with any follow-up information that I can around that.
Maybe a quick follow-up.
Yes.
Just anecdotally, I think we hear that kids are drinking younger and younger, so 13 is a nice benchmark to move forward, but just curious about what's available as far as study for those younger ones.
Okay.
Any other questions for Ms. Wheeler? Thank you very much. Mr. Williams.
Yes, good morning. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Rudy Williams. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and our mission, quite simply, is to promote the public interest through the responsible sale and services of alcoholic beverages. Before beginning, I have to apologize. This is the first time I've been before this distinguished body. Chairman Lane was going to speak, and he asked me to represent him as well as the agency, and I hope by the end of the day I can do that very well. I also want to state for the record, if I may please, that I'm fighting a tremendous head cold, so I've got my rag. I may have to stop, blow my nose, whatever, and I'll do my best to ensure that this microphone doesn't get my germs for the next panel coming up, so forgive me. A couple of things I wanted to share with you. I wanted to do something a little bit different. I don't really have a prepared text. What I really wanted to do is have a conversation. I believe you have some materials that are in front of you, and Attorney Schrado kind of did an excellent job in presenting the two bills, 2151 and 2150. And what I wanted to do is just have a conversation about those bills and answer any questions that you may have. I noticed that there were questions about the knowing factor. I'm prepared to speak about that a little bit with respect to how do we know. And then I want to talk a little bit about 2150, which is the random decoy operations. Let me start and begin, first of all, by saying that random decoy operations is probably one of the most effective tools that we have in curbing underage drinking. I don't know if you were aware of the fact that recently Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and Marion County, we had very successful minor decoy operations with local law enforcement. And those operations in themselves help get the word out on being responsible, checking IDs, and trying to keep minors away from having alcoholic beverages. The other thing I wanted to share with you is that we work with local law enforcement, and just as an addition to House Bill 2150, when we think about it, Portland is the largest city in the state, as you know. And when we work with local law enforcement, for the most part, one of the biggest problems that they're having is, in fact, doing minor decoy operations. We ask for you to seriously consider this bill for several reasons. In doing so, it would allow for them to look at a particular geographical area or target when populations are, when they have a population of 500,000 or more. But if they can look at an area with 20,000, they can specifically do random decoy operations. It will allow the local law enforcement to either go to the precinct areas and then do random decoy operations there, or they can do it citywide. So it becomes more of a unified approach and becomes more consistent and conforms more with the rest of the state. There was a question.
Mr. Williams, could I break in with a question about that?
Yes.
That is, the way the bill is designed now, it's limited to Portland, but in areas of 20,000 population or more. And so we have a number of cities that are not nearly as big as Portland, wouldn't get to the $500,000 threshold under the bill, but which are substantially more than 20,000. So, like the city of Salem, for example, 120,000 citizens, I think, something in that ballpark. Why is this bill not seeking to be able to do random sampling within decoy operations within a lesser area in the city of Salem, for example, as long as it's 20,000 in population?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, this doesn't preclude doing it in Salem. In fact, Salem does do random minor decoy operations. The problem that the larger cities have is that based upon the density of the population, traffic, things of that sort, it doesn't allow for any of the licensees to have an equal opportunity to be selected. That's not necessarily the case in Salem or any of the other cities. So the statute is clear. For those places that have 20,000, they actually do random decoy operations.
I'll follow up with that. The question is, in Portland, for them to be effective, you don't want to do them citywide because of $500,000, apparently, it doesn't have the same impact. But I think what you're saying is that within Salem, where there are 120,000 residents, that a citywide program can still be effective. Is that what you're telling us?
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, yes, I am. And I'm saying that in those cities with 120,000 or more, they can look at those localities where they have a population of 20,000 and do random decoy operations.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wisnett, before we go on, I'm sorry I'm not familiar. Could you define or describe to us a minor decoy operation and what your guidelines are?
Chairman McPherson, Representative, in front of you, I believe there's a packet. Our statutes and our administrative rules talk about doing four things. One, that the minor must be 21 years of age. Secondly, that the minor must...
Which paper is that? That we received today. Mr. Chair, I would kindly ask if we can get this early ahead so we'd have that. I wouldn't embarrass myself. It'll take the time of us.
Some of us are beyond embarrassment, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative, do you want me to continue on that? Or do you need time to read that?
I have not, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Mr. Williams, I just want to clarify. As I read the House Bill 2150, it says that a random or targeted basis in cities with populations of 20,000 or more. You made a statement that, this bill is intended to allow the city of Portland, for example, population over 500,000, to break it down into a 20,000 population area and target that area. Am I correct in understanding what this bill is intent to do, correct?
Chairman McPherson, Representative, yes.
Okay, when I read the bill, though, a city of Salem, as the chair was saying, of 120,000, it doesn't allow them, because they are not over 500,000, to target just an area of 20,000 people. It still allows them, it still, from what I understand, it still makes the city of Salem to use the whole entire population of 120 to do their random test. Is that correct?
Representative McPherson. That's correct. Salem doesn't have the problem in terms of having individuals be randomly selected as much. There's a fair chance of a licensee being selected easier. even with a population of 120,000, it doesn't pose the kinds of problems that it does in larger cities. So to your question specifically, it does allow for them to do that.
I think the last phrase, I think, is what may have thrown
right.
So that is, I think that Representative Cameron and I, our understanding is the same, which is that under this bill, Salem could only do citywide random decoy testing or random decoy operations. And what I understood you to say earlier is that works operationally. You can have the desired effect even when you're doing it randomly across the entire city. But if you were if we kept requiring random operations across the entire city of Portland, that would be too big and wouldn't have the impact on the retailers.
Chairman McPherson, Representative, yes, I'm saying that. I'm sorry for the confusion.
Okay.
A follow-up then. Why, I guess if it's good enough for the city of Salem as 120,000 population, why wouldn't we make it 120,000 in the city of Portland?
Chairman McPherson, Representative, if I understand the question, that's what we're asking to do with the 500,000, to allow for them to go to those areas that have 20,000. If you're asking me why don't we make it 120,000 in the city of Portland, I can't speak to the specific demographics around that, but I can tell you in working with law enforcement, it becomes very convoluted and complex. It would be a lot easier to break it down to 20,000 within the precincts, and then they'll have a more effective job, a more effective opportunity to do the random decoys.
One last thing. I just would like to make a note for the record that we ought to allow local or City of Salem to allow them to break it down to a 20,000 population as well.
Any further questions? Representative Barker.
I'm a little confused, too, about this. The random, but if a town, Coburg, somebody, they want to run, they don't have to do random, do they? Can they do selective enforcement? Or I mean, if I'm the chief of a little town, I can say there's two taverns in town I know are selling to kids. So do I have to still check everybody, or can I go ahead and send my decoys to those two places?
Chairman McPherson, Representative, it might be easier to say that the local law enforcement can go any place at any time. They can do random as well as targeted within their communities. What we're saying is that in order for us to have a unified random minor decoy operations where you want sanctions on the licensees, you will have to follow our particular administrative rules and statutes. And in order to do that, this particular bill is allowing for us to do. But that doesn't preclude the local law enforcement from going into any place and doing random or targeted. Now, if they do target it, there has to be a documented compliance plan. And it's hard to do that if they don't have the 20,000 that are in place. But they can go in, document that. They can come back to us. If they follow our particular administrative rules, then we can go in and cite those individuals administratively as they're citing criminally.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Then thank you, Mr. Williams. Thank you, Ms. Wheeler. We'll call up then our next panel, which is Lorna Youngs of the DMV and Walt Beglau, Marion County District Attorney. And I also have a note here that Sergeant Plummer from the Oregon State Police might be in attendance. They probably wasn't going to make it, but I think the word is he has not arrived. So we'll hear from these two. Please begin by identifying yourselves for the record in whatever order you choose.
Members of the committee, I'm Lorna Youngs with Department of Transportation. I'm the administrator of the DMV, and I'm here to speak specifically to House Bill 2152. That is the creation of a minor in possession administrative suspension, patterned very much on the existing administrative suspension under implied consent. And the purpose of this particular piece of legislation is to address the issue that was spoken to by previous witnesses about the inconsistency of sanctions against minors, because it depends upon the resources of the court as well as the the approaches in individual jurisdictions might take to whether or not a citation for minor in possession will ultimately end up in court. This administrative sanction is not meant to replace that, but to run parallel with it, just as the implied consent program runs parallel with the citation and ultimate adjudication by court for driving under the influence. And one of the questions that was asked earlier was whether or not this legislation appears in any other states. And we were not able to find an example of another state that has the same administrative suspension. There are many states, of course, with implied consent, but a specific administrative suspension for minor in possession, regardless of whether or not that individual was in a car at the time in which they were cited for minor in possession, thus far we haven't been able to find another state that has a law on the books that's doing that. And so hence the reason why this was crafted pretty much following a lot of the guidelines or the existing statutes, as well as using the process that's already in place for implied consent. So essentially what happens now is that an officer, using the definition of minor in possession, would cite an individual, and that citation ultimately can make its way to court. But if this bill were passed, it would also be sent to the DMV, and that upon citation, the individual would be provided with notice that they will have their license administratively suspended within 30 days. They have 10 days to contest that, or to notice us that they wish to contest it, and then a contested case hearing would be held, as a day they do with implied consent within the citation period, so that the final order for the contested case would be issued prior to that 30-day time of suspension. If the individual prevails at the contested case, there is no suspension. If they do not prevail at the contested case, then the suspension goes into effect. At the same time, that citation can also make its way to the court system. Now, the reason that the age was chosen between 15 and 20 is obviously, even though we've heard a great deal of testimony about the fact that underage drinking occurs as young as 11, the immediacy of a license suspension when you turn 15, that your ability to apply for a license might be suspended, may not be much of a deterrent to an 11-year-old. So we focused on that age group, 15 to 20, that could either apply for a driving permit or hold a driving permit. And as was testified by Judge Cooper, the withdrawal of the driving privilege for possession of minors with alcohol has already been on the books for some time. And so much of the elements that you see in this bill are simply patterned on existing elements that have been in the law. The choice of 90-day suspension for the first infraction and 1 year for the subsequent infraction was patterned off what already exists in statute in 809-260, where judges may order a suspension for 90 days. Essentially, the way the law is written, the suspension that they order for being in possession of alcohol may be lifted within 90 days, which is effectively giving a person a 90-day suspension. And so much of the elements that you see here are not new in terms of what the sanction would be and how the process would work. What is new is that you would have an administrative suspension in place for minors between the ages of 15 and 20, in addition to any court, any ultimate action that would occur in court. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have on that.
Any questions? Mr. Bonamici.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that I understand procedurally how this is going to work. There's a minor who's pulled over. There's a can of beer in the car. The officer takes the driver's license and gives a temporary permission to drive for 30 days. Is that correct? And then if the minor does not request a hearing, then after that 30 days, there's another 60 days when they can't drive, unless they apply for emergency exception?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonaducci, Bonamici, I'm sorry. I can't quite read that. This is patterned, as I said, on the implied consent law. And what happens
what would happen is you would be cited for minor in possession whether you're in a vehicle or at a party. It doesn't matter where you are. The citation and the criteria for the citation already exist for whatever action police officers are already taking when they cite an individual for minor in possession. Then procedurally what they would do, should that minor possess a driver license, they will confiscate it. If they possess a permit, they'll confiscate it. If they don't possess either, obviously they won't. But because the suspension does not go into effect for 30 days, they will give them a temporary driver license, which is similar to what happens with adults under implied consent. That individual then has an opportunity to contest. And because what we're trying to do is to make sure that the contested case hearing, in order for this to be a swift process, you can't let that languish. So the entire contested case process needs to occur within that 30-day suspension period. So the individual has 10 days to contest. If they don't contest, in 30 days, the suspension goes into effect. It will be 90-day suspension for the first offense. After 30 days, the individual may apply for a hardship permit. A hardship permit is limited to driving to and from work or driving for treatment. So there's very specific things in the statute or other particular, you know, emergencies, and you have specific routes. And this is aimed at recognition that the hardship permit is really aimed at working adults, if you think. And in many cases, we have to realize that if you're capturing a population age 15 to 20, we're not all talking about youth. There may be emancipated individuals at the age of 18 who are heads of household, working, raising families, but they are still not allowed to drink in the possession of alcohol. And so a hardship permit would allow them to still get to and from work, who in from treatment, and we already have a process in place for hardship permits for suspensions of all types, so we would simply apply that process. If you have a subsequent arrest for minor in possession, the suspension is for a year, and there's a longer wait time before you can get a hardship permit, and of course, after two or three of these, you don't get to have a hardship permit. There is also a provision under our current statutes for youths to get emergency permits, and those are primarily been used for youths as young as age 14, specifically for those youths who cannot get to school. There is no public transportation available to them, and they're in a rural setting. They may be going to a private school, or for some reason, and so we have very few of those. Just a handful of those issued every year, and so we did want to make provision. And already exist in statute where a minor who is eligible for an emergency permit in order to get to school, because we didn't want to deprive minors who are still in high school of the ability to get to school if there was absolutely no public transportation for them to still be able to get to school. So that still would be managed under our existing emergency permit program. But you could choose, but you cannot get one or the other. So there's provision for due process, provision for the ability to drive for those individuals who need it for emergency. And the standards for arrest are the same standards that currently exist for minor in possession, and the standards under which they would be heard in the hearing are the same standards that would be applied should they be heard in court.
Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Youngs, is there any way to guess how many of those who would be cited might contest their citation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, we do not know that because of the fact that there isn't a track record. So when we took a look at the fiscal impact of the bill, and the primary driver of the fiscal impact on the bill is the contested case hearing, but there are approximately 600 a case to conduct. We put together several scenarios. There are about 13,000 minor in possession citations issued every year. So we looked at, 10, 15, 20% ask for a contested case hearing and develop various scenarios for what those costs are. Currently, the rate of a contested case hearing for implied consent is running between 20 and 25%. However, their contested case hearings for implied consent are a little more complex, and in many cases, those hearings are being used often as a trial or a test for the ultimate evidence that might be used in the court. So you might find a lesser rate of contested case hearing requests, but maybe not initially, because people will want to see, you know, whether or not this will stick. So, as we get further into the bill and we talk about the fiscal impact, what we're proposing is a surcharge on the hardship reinstatement, suspension reinstatement fee across the board, which we would propose to be set by rule. And we'll you know, bring forward with you various scenarios for what we think that might be, depending upon an estimated level of hearings, because there is a fiscal impact to DMV to set this up and a fiscal impact to process suspensions, but those are certainly outweighed by the cost of the hearings.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then Mr. Beglau.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglau. I'm Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Office. In their totality, I would dub this set of bills as the Underage Drinking Accountability Bill. Inherent throughout this package, it's clear that accountability for kids who drink, parents who provide, the courts, particularly in assessing the alcohol treatment needs of an individual, a law enforcement tool right out there in the streets, in the homes where kids are drinking, and for alcohol vendors and proprietors alike. And for me, it was very effective last night when I had the Attorney General's report at the dinner table with my son, who may be getting his license tomorrow, to be able to say, if you drink and get caught anywhere, regardless of your car or operating it, there's a consequence. And boy, I really got his attention with that. I personally played a very small role in the task force, but I really think they have done a good job in identifying the relationship between alcohol consumption, kids, and the benchmarks in the life of a child, such as school performance, mental health issues, and crime itself. As the prosecutor of this county, I can tell you time and time again, the access, the unfettered access to alcohol, the lack of supervision of kids, and this almost promotional attitude in our communities directly leads to child fatality and tragedy. Kids go to parties and they drink, and then they get into cars. That's what happens. And my office is faced with that, along with all the other counties across this state, on an every day. So these bills have developed that, enhanced that level of accountability for those critical access points I would describe for you, where kids are getting alcohol. It's going to enhance the tools for law enforcement. I know the sergeant from the state police here, but that'll allow them to work much more effectively where kids are going to be most impacted. And it's going to mark a prominent shift in the culture surrounding kids and alcohol, drawing attention to and giving teeth to consumption at parties, so with little no penalties right now, the risk again between drinking and driving, and highlight the treatment component, the assessment and treatment component that young people need to be impacted by. Let me tell you, our judge in our juvenile department here, time and time again, that common profile of a child is at age 10 they're drinking. They add marijuana at 12, mm-hmm. and they add methamphetamine at age 15. And so, as someone described earlier, this gateway component, this is really a valuable set of tools that we're going to be drawing upon here. As it relates to House Bill 2152, again, this is going to promote that uniformity outside the justice system, and we would strongly support that. And so we're here to express our support. I know I'm at the end of the panels here, and really proud of the collaborative effort that this the task force and this group has brought to the committee here today.
Any questions for Mr. Beglau? Then I was passed a note here from the judicial branch just asking what, if any, increase in the workload of our courts might result from the enactment of this package.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, particularly with the enhancement to the A misdemeanor endangering the welfare, you will see caseloads edge up, clearly, not only for prosecutors, but law enforcement on the street, and naturally, because we prosecute those cases in our courts, for the courts themselves. However, I think the key here is that this will it'll just be an edge up, and will be done in a way that allows the enforcement component to be more effective, and a lot of tools in that sense. Also, in terms of workloads, as a prosecutor, I thought about that. We've got to do triage around all of the work that we do, but your prosecutors and your courts put prioritization around those, and kids and alcohol, relative to what we see happening with kids and getting involved in the system, that priority is going to shift. So clearly it'll edge up, but I don't think it'll be overwhelming.
If there are no further questions, I'll excuse this panel then. We have several other witnesses have signed up to testify as well, and with the indulgence of the committee, I'd like to continue on, because this, I realize there's a lot of material here, but it was a logical package of bills, and we wanted to get all the information out that we could, so we'll continue on for a few minutes here. Ann Christian, could you come forward, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I should tell you at the outset that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, of course, and indeed, does not support underage drinking. The members of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers are not simply criminal defense lawyers. We have a number of members who represent individuals in juvenile dependency proceedings, both parents and infants and children who are the subject of abuse. And so our membership is much wider than our name would indicate. And I signed up to provide some concerns of our association on only two of the bills. And listening to some of the testimony, if I could, with the chair's permission, after I'm done testifying about the two bills that we have concerns about, I'd like to just touch on some of the concerns raised about the other bills by members of this committee. But I'll start with House Bill 2144. That's the expansion of endangering the welfare of a minor. And our concerns, we don't oppose trying to ensure that youth minors do not engage in underage drinking. We have two concerns with this bill. One is the breadth of the provision. So what this bill does is it adds to endangering the welfare of a minor a provision as far as being in, remaining in a place where unlawful activity relating to alcohol is added to existing law. Existing law covers remaining in a place where there are controlled substance. So one of the examples is an infant who is left in a house where controlled substances are currently being used. And current law does cover that. And current law does say that that is a crime of endangering the welfare of a minor. And I think everyone can understand why that is the case. When our legislative committee was meeting on this, we thought about the breadth of this when it pertains to alcohol. And here is just simply an example of our concern. An individual who is 22 years old, who is legal to consume alcohol, is in a house, and maybe Representative Comp, this is the frat example, maybe it isn't, could be just someone in their own home. So a 22-year-old is in his or her own home, and there is illegal drinking occurring in that house by the little brother, who is 17 and a half. Now, if the 22-year-old brother had provided the alcohol to his little brother, under current existing law, that 22-year-old brother could be charged with furnishing alcohol to a minor. That's a Class A misdemeanor. It's been on the books for ages. So that individual could already be prosecuted for furnishing alcohol to a minor. The proposed folding in to endangering the welfare of a minor, that crime currently is a Class A misdemeanor as well. So we're trying to determine what behavior or actions currently are not covered by existing law. And so one of our concerns always is, why is there a need, if there's a crime on the books already, to expand yet another law? We think the use of the word place, and this may be covered otherwise in case law, but place is pretty broad as well. And so in my example earlier with regard to an infant, we think of infants in a house where there's meth being used or meth being cooked, and to me that is endangering the welfare of a minor. So think back to the scenario of the 22-year-old with his 17 and a half year old brother, where they're drinking and older brother could be charged with furnishing alcohol to a minor. What if there's an infant child downstairs in the place where the unlawful activity is taking place as far as alcohol? So one of our concerns, and maybe it can be fixed with some narrowing of the language, is just the breadth of the of House Bill 2144. The other is the fact that existing law, at least we believe, covers this, existing law being furnishing alcohol to a minor. And I would pick up that a number of individuals have talked about the fact that maybe furnishing alcohol to a minor is not currently being enforced, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's the courts. And having been employed by the Judicial Department in a former life for 15 years, I do know that courts and law enforcement and DAs, as DA Bigelow said, do have to triage. And so if it's an issue that under current law, furnishing alcohol to a minor currently isn't being pursued, and therefore we want to create a new crime to cover it, to me, why don't we put the resources into enforcing current law, furnishing alcohol to a minor, rather than expand endangering the welfare of a minor? So that's my testimony with respect to this bill, and we have one other bill, Mr. Chair, that we have concerns about. And I'd take questions, if you'd like, on this one, or I can wait.
Well, why don't you go ahead and comment on the other, and we'll take questions on both.
Thank you. House Bill 2146 is the other bill that we have, that Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers have concerns about. And here's the concern in a nutshell. Judicial discretion. Why is it, I would ask many individuals, that we don't trust judges to consider the individual who is before the judge today? This bill makes a simple change. It changes the word may with respect to the court to shall with respect to ordering driving privileges be suspended. An individual, it's been mentioned, in rural Oregon may depend on a license to drive to school. I'm not certain there's an emergency exception under this provision, but our position is that it ought to be, decisions such as this ought to be made by a live human being, a judge, sitting in the courtroom who has the opportunity to listen to the specific details of what occurred with respect to the youth's behavior, what is the circumstance of the youth, what is the circumstance of the parents, and have the judge make the decision as opposed to just having a mandate, yet another erosion, I would suggest, of judicial discretion. The other concern with regard to 2146 is that there is no requirement that the individual actually be convicted of minor in possession. So I heard the testimony with regard to this, just a moment, that this bill simply mirrors adult criminal provisions. And I would suggest that the adult provision we find offensive because it is based on an individual simply being issued a citation, and it's simply based on a failure to appear as opposed to an individual being, there is a crime, a failure to appear, and the person could be convicted of that and have the license suspension, but this is based merely on the fact that the person has failed to appear. There are emergencies that occur. If I'm cited to appear in court for speeding and I fail to appear, it could be willful, I'm not going to appear, or it could be that I had an emergency. Those are the issues. Why didn't I appear? Was there a mistake on the summons? Those are the issues that are addressed by the court and part of the determination of whether I'm convicted. The fact simply that I've been issued a citation ought not to result in suspension of my license. So those are the two concerns that we have with respect to the other bill, Mr. Chair, that I signed up to testify on.
Thank you, Ms. Christian. Are there any questions for this witness? Then I think you're excused. Thank you very much. Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, and there's some written testimony that's being passed around, and I intend, due to the late hour, only just to highlight a couple of issues. I served as a member of the task force, fully engaged and involved in its deliberations, and I was proud to represent the nation's leading distillers on that task force. And we are strongly in support and urge your support of House Bills 2144 through 49 and 2152. We're still evaluating 2150 and 2151. They do not affect my association's members, but they affect the customers of my members, and we're still in discussions with that. I would just like to highlight that 2152, I think, is a very important part of this package, and perhaps from our perspective, the most important part of the package. It's the administrative license revocation. And as your prior witness mentioned, discretion in judicial acts is very important, but what we found from the data, and I wish I had brought the specific data to recite to you, is that judges suspending licenses for minors in possession through the current judicial system varies from essentially zero in some counties to a great percentage in other counties. And there's one county in Oregon, if I remember the data correct, it's a smaller county in Oregon, where more minors have suspended licenses for having minor in possession than all the other counties in the state put together. So clearly what we're not talking about here is the exercise of individual judicial discretion. The system isn't working well in some counties, and the administrative license revocation process is intended to be consistent, fair, with due process, but everyone in the state will be treated the same for this issue, and so we think that's a major improvement. It doesn't change what the offense is. It doesn't change what the punishment is. It changes how the process works and makes it consistent. The only other thing I would mention is DISCUS and its members have been involved and seriously concerned about underage drinking for years, and if you notice on the testimony, we were involved in funding the development of the breathalyzer in the 40s. We were involved in funding students against drunk driving, students against drunk driving in the 70s and the Century Council in the 90s. So we've been involved in this issue and hope that Oregon can join us in supporting, and this committee can join us in supporting this package of bills, and in particular, House Bill 2152, the administrative license revocation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Cosgrove?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, great work by this committee and everything, but there was only two drafts that did not have, everyone voting for. And I was wondering, since I have empathy for minority now, that we could have it. Is there a written report by these members that voted no, or is there any information this committee should have on why they opposed those two?
I do not believe there were minority reports. I'm sure that those folks who didn't support bills can tell you why, and I may not be the very best person to remember all of theirs, but I don't recall there was any written minority reports as part of the process.
Thank you.
Mr. Tradel agrees that that's correct.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And Bill Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try to be brief also. I'm Bill Perry, represent the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I want to say the whole concept of the administrative procedures against minors' licenses is something that we've been pursuing for a long time. There are three people that have, I think, a part in trying to control underage drinking. They're obviously the person that's trying to drink, the clerk or retailer, and the licensee. And as of right now, there's punishments for all, but as has been mentioned earlier, the court system in certain counties are overloaded, and they tend not to enforce the revocation of a license for a minor. So the person actually trying to commit the crime doesn't get punished, but the other people in the process, both the licensee and the server, have an administrative penalty that can happen against a man, a criminal. And I will say generally for the server or the clerk, OLCC will make if the criminal, the counties go after the criminal sanction, they'll drop the administrative one, but if the criminal one gets dropped, they'll go after the administrative one. So there's these checks and balances for everybody in the chain except the person trying to buy, and I think this gives that check and balance to the person trying to buy. The only bill that I have an issue with is 2151, which is the knowingly standard. And I just to give kind of an example, I think the example is given, some people kind of ignore it, and we're trying to capture those people, and I don't have any harm with that concept. But I would also say that I think the problem that we have as retailers sometimes, I do everything that's asked of me. I try to train my employees. I have practices, standards set in place, and sometimes my employees forget them. Sometimes they ignore them, and I penalize them. I can fire them. I can take away hours. I can do certain things that happened as a revocation, but that does not serve to really the penalty. And I would give just kind of a one example of I hire a lot of 21-year-olds. And anybody that's hired 21-year-olds knows that the age range of the people that hang out with them are 19 to 23. And if you see these people that could be 19, 20 years old hanging out outside the establishment, you can say, look, I know they're underage. You better not let them in when I'm gone. You better not try to serve them when I'm gone. Under the knowingly standard, I think I have a defense under that. Under the should-have-known standard, if that employee serves those people, I think my defense in trying to prevent that from happening is gone, because I think strictly by informing them that I have the policy, you cannot serve those two people, I think it's harder to argue that I should have known it was going to happen. And it just, that should have known, I think, eliminates some of my protections as I try to address some of these problems that knowingly doesn't. It's just a concern we have with that specific language in the law. And that's the only bill at this point in time that we have any real concerns with. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to, or I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Perry? Thank you very much. We're past our time here. We're not going to be going to work session on these bills, and I think that what I'll do is not take any more testimony today. And obviously, there's some of these bills that raise issues, and we'll probably get some further public attention in the future. We do have some written testimony that was submitted by the Century Council, which is a nonprofit organization supported by the leading national distillers. Supporting all these bills except for 2151. So we'll enter that into the record. That concludes our work today. Thank you, committee, for your patience. We're adjourned.